Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. The invitation was completely unexpected. One morning during the same 1972 visit, John was sitting in an office he had been given at the Instituto de Recursos Hidráulico y Electrificación, Panama's government-owned electric utility company. He was poring over a sheet of statistics when a man knocked gently on the frame of his open door. John invited him in, pleased with any excuse to take his attention off the numbers. The man announced himself as the general's chauffeur, and he had come to take John to one of the general's bungalows. An hour later, John was sitting across the table from General Omar Torrijos, who was dressed casually in typical Panamanian style. He wore khaki slacks and a short-sleeved shirt buttoned down the front, light blue with a delicate green pattern. The general was tall, fit, and handsome. He seemed amazingly relaxed for a man with his responsibilities. A lock of dark hair fell over his prominent forehead. The general asked about John's recent travels to Indonesia, Guatemala, and Iran. The three countries fascinated him, but he seemed especially intrigued with Iran's king, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The Shah had come to power in 1941 after the British and Soviets overthrew his father, whom they accused of collaborating with Hitler. Can you imagine, Torrijos asked, being a part of a plot to dethrone your own father? Panama's head of state knew a good deal about the history of this far-off land. They talked about how the tables were turned on the Shah in 1951 and how his own premier, Mohammad Mossadegh, forced him into exile. Torrijos knew, as did most of the world, that it had been the CIA that labeled the premier a communist and that stepped in to restore the Shah to power. However, he did not know, or at least did not mention, the parts Claudine had shared with John about Kermit Roosevelt's brilliant maneuvers and the fact that this had been the beginning of a new era in imperialism, the match that had ignited the global empire conflagration. After the Shah was reinstated, Torrijos continued, he launched a series of revolutionary programs aimed at developing the industrial sector and bringing Iran into the modern era. John asked him how he happened to know so much about Iran. I make it my point, he said. I don't think too highly of the Shah's politics, his willingness to overthrow his own father and become a CIA puppet, but it looks as though he's doing good things for his country. Perhaps I can learn something from him, if he survives. You think he won't? John asked. He has powerful enemies, said the general. John's response was, and some of the world's best bodyguards. Torrijos gave John a sardonic look. His secret police, SAVAK, has the reputation of being ruthless thugs. That doesn't win many friends. He won't last much longer. The general paused, then rolled his eyes. Bodyguards? I have a few myself. He waved at the door. You think they'll save my life if your country decides to get rid of me? John asked whether he truly saw that as a possibility. The general raised his eyebrows in a manner that made John feel foolish for asking such a question. We have the canal. That's a lot bigger than Arbenz and United Fruit. John had researched Guatemala and he understood Torrijos's meaning. United Fruit Company had been that country's political equivalent of Panama's canal. Founded in the late 1800s, United Fruit soon grew into one of the most powerful forces in Central America. During the early 1950s, reform candidate Jacobo Arbenz was elected president of Guatemala in an election hailed all over the hemisphere as a model of the democratic process. At the time, less than 3% of Guatemalans owned 70% of the land. Arbenz promised to help the poor dig their way out of starvation, and after his election, he implemented a comprehensive land reform program. The poor and middle classes throughout Latin America applauded Arbenz, Torrijos said. Personally, he was one of my heroes, but we also held our breath. We knew that United Fruit opposed these measures, since they were one of the largest and most oppressive landholders in Guatemala. They also owned big plantations in Colombia, Costa Rica, Cuba, Jamaica, Nicaragua, Santo Domingo, and here in Panama. They couldn't afford to let Arbenz give the rest of us ideas. John knew the rest. United Fruit had launched a major public relations campaign in the United States aimed at convincing the American public and Congress that Arbenz was part of a Russian plot and that Guatemala was a Soviet satellite. In 1954, the CIA orchestrated a coup. American pilots bombed Guatemala City, and the democratically elected Arbenz was overthrown, replaced by Colonel Carlos Castillo Armas, a ruthless right-wing dictator. The new government owed everything to United Fruit. By way of thanks, the government reversed the land reform process, abolished taxes on the interest and dividends paid to foreign investors, eliminated the secret ballot, and jailed thousands of its critics. Anyone who dared to speak out against Castillo was persecuted. Historians trace the violence and terrorism that plagued Guatemala for most of the rest of the century to the not-so-secret alliance between United Fruit, the CIA, and the Guatemalan army under its colonel dictator. And I'll return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Arbenz was assassinated, Torrijos continued. Political and character assassination. He paused and frowned. How could your people swallow that CIA rubbish? I won't go so easily. The military here are my people. Political assassination won't do. He smiled. The CIA itself will have to kill me. They sat in silence for a few moments, each lost in his own thoughts. Torrijos was the first to speak. He leaned forward and lowered his voice. "And now I'm up against Bechtel." This startled John. Bechtel was the world's most powerful engineering firm and a frequent collaborator on projects with Maine. In the case of Panama's master plan, John had assumed that they were one of the major competitors. "What do you mean?" asked John. "We have been considering building a new canal, a sea level one, without locks. It can handle bigger ships. The Japanese may be interested in financing it." "They're the canal's biggest clients," said John. "Exactly. Of course, if they provide the money, they will do the construction," said the general. It struck John. Bechtel will be out in the cold. "The biggest construction job in recent history," added the general. He paused. "Bechtel's loaded with Nixon, Ford, and Bush cronies. Bush as U.S. ambassador to the UN and Ford as House Minority Leader and chairman of the Republican National Convention were well known to Torrijos as Republican power brokers. I've been told that the Bechtel family pulls the strings of the Republican Party." The conversation left John feeling very uncomfortable. He was one of the people who perpetrated the system the general so despised, and he was certain the general knew it. John's job of convincing him to accept international loans in exchange for hiring U.S. engineering and construction firms appeared to have hit a mammoth wall. John decided to confront him head on. "General," he asked, "why did you invite me here?" The general glanced at his watch and smiled. "Yes, time now to get down to our own business. Panama needs your help. I need your help." John was stunned. "My help? What can I do for you?" "We will take back the canal, but that's not enough." He relaxed in his chair. "We must also serve as a model. We must show that we care about our poor, and we must demonstrate beyond any doubt that our determination to win our independence is not dictated by Russia, China, or Cuba. We must prove to the world that Panama is a reasonable country, that we stand not against the United States, but for the rights of the poor." The general continued, "In order to do that, we need to build up an economic base that is like none in this hemisphere. Electricity, yes, but electricity that reaches the poorest of our poor and is subsidized. The same for transportation and communications, and especially for agriculture. Doing that will take money, your money, the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank." Once again, John leaned forward. The general's eyes held John's. "I understand that your company wants more work and usually gets it by inflating the size of projects. Wider highways, bigger power plants, deeper harbors. This time is different, though. Give me what's best for my people, and I'll give you all the work you want." What the general proposed was totally unexpected, and it both shocked and excited John. It certainly defied all he had learned at Maine. Surely the general knew that the foreign aid game was a sham. He had to know. It existed to make leaders rich and to shackle their countries with debt. It was there so Panama would be forever obliged to the United States and the corporatocracy. It was there to keep Latin America on the path of manifest destiny and forever subservient to Washington and Wall Street. John was certain that the general knew that the system was based on the assumption that all men in power are corruptible, and that the general's decision not to use it for his personal benefit would be seen as a threat, a new form of domino that might start a chain reaction and eventually topple the entire system. John looked across the table at this man who certainly understood that because of the canal, he enjoyed a very special and unique power, and that it had placed him in a particularly precarious position. He had to be careful. He already had established himself as a leader among LDC leaders. If he, like his hero R. Benz, was determined to take a stand, the world would be watching. How would the system react? More specifically, how would the U.S. government react? Latin American history was littered with dead heroes. John also knew he was looking at a man who challenged all the justifications he had formulated for his own actions. This man certainly had his own share of personal flaws, but he was no pirate, no Henry Morgan or Francis Drake, those swashbuckling adventurers who used letters of marque from English kings as a cloak to legitimize piracy. The picture on the billboard had not been your typical political deception. Omar's ideal is freedom. The missile is not invented that can kill an ideal. Hadn't Tom Paine penned something similar? It made John wonder, though. Perhaps ideals do not die, but what about the men behind them? Che, Arbenz, Allende? The latter was the only one still alive, but for how long? And it raised another question. How would John respond if Torrijos were thrust into the role of martyr? By the time John left him, they both understood that Maine would get the contract for the master plan and that John would see to it that they did Torrijos' bidding. According to the writer, John Perkins, they were now entering a new and sinister period in economic history. As chief economist, he not only was in charge of a department at Maine and responsible for the studies they carried out around the globe, but he also was expected to be conversant with current economic trends and theories. The early 1970s were a time of major shifts in international economics. During the 1960s, a group of countries had formed OPEC, the cartel of oil-producing nations, largely in response to the power of the big refining companies. Iran was also a major factor. Even though the Shah owed his position and possibly his life to the United States' clandestine intervention during the Mossadegh struggle, or perhaps because of that fact, the Shah was acutely aware that the tables could be turned on him at any time. The heads of state of other petroleum-rich nations shared this awareness and the paranoia that accompanied it. They also knew that the major international oil companies, known as the Seven Sisters, were collaborating to hold down petroleum prices, and thus the revenues they pay to the producing countries, as a means of reaping their own windfall profits. OPEC was organized in order to strike back. This all came to a head in the early 1970s when OPEC brought the industrial giants to their knees. A series of concerted actions, ending with a 1973 oil embargo, symbolized by long lines at U.S. gas stations, threatened to bring on an economic catastrophe rivaling the Great Depression. It was a systemic shock to the developed world economy, and of a magnitude that few people could begin to comprehend. The oil crisis could not have come at a worse time for the United States. It was a confused nation, full of fear and self-doubt, reeling from a humiliating war in Vietnam, and a president who was about to resign. Nixon's problems were not limited to Southeast Asia and Watergate. He has stepped up to the plate during an era that, in retrospect, would be understood as the threshold of a new epoch in world politics and economics. In those days, it seemed that the little guys, including the OPEC countries, were getting the upper hand. And I'll come back to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I am speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. John was fascinated by world events. His bread was buttered by the corporatocracy, yet some secret side of him enjoyed watching his masters being put in their places. He supposed it assuaged his guilt a bit. He saw the shadow of Thomas Paine standing on the sidelines, cheering OPEC on. No one could have been aware of the full impact of the embargo at the time it was happening. They certainly had theories, but they could not understand what has since become clear. In hindsight, they know that the economic growth rates after the oil crisis were about half those prevailing in the 1950s and 1960s, and that they have taken place against much greater inflationary pressure. The growth that did occur was structurally different and did not create nearly as many jobs, so unemployment soared. To top it all off, the international monetary system took a blow. The network of fixed exchange rates, which had prevailed since the end of World War II, essentially collapsed. During that time, John frequently got together with friends to discuss these matters over lunch or over beers after work. Some of these people worked for him. His staff included very smart men and women, mostly young, who for the most part were free thinkers, at least by conventional standards. Others were executives at Boston think tanks or professors at local colleges, and one was an assistant to a state congressman. These were informal meetings, sometimes attended by as few as two, while others might include a dozen participants. The sessions were always lively and raucous. When John looks back at those discussions, he is embarrassed by the sense of superiority he often felt. He knew things he could not share. His friends sometimes flaunted their credentials, connections on Beacon Hill or in Washington, professorships and PhDs, and John would answer this in his role as chief economist of a major consulting firm who traveled around the world first class. Yet he could not discuss his private meetings with men like Torrijos or the things he knew about the ways they were manipulating countries on every continent. It was both a source of inner arrogance and a frustration. When they talked about the power of the little guys, John had to exercise a great deal of restraint. He knew what none of them could possibly know, that the corporatocracy, its band of EHMs, and the jackals waiting in the background would never allow the little guys to gain control. He only had to draw upon the examples of Arbenz and Mossadegh, and more recently, upon the 1973 CIA overthrow of Chile's democratically elected president, Salvador Allende. In fact, he understood that the stranglehold of global empire was growing stronger, despite OPEC, or as he suspected at the time, but did not confirm until later, with OPEC's help. The conversations often focused on the similarities between the early 1970s and the 1930s. The latter represented a major watershed in the international economy and in the way it was studied, analyzed, and perceived. That decade opened the door to Keynesian economics and to the idea that government should play a major role in managing markets and providing services such as health, unemployment, compensation, and other forms of welfare. They were moving away from old assumptions that markets were self-regulating and that the state's intervention should be minimal. The Depression resulted in the New Deal and in policies that promoted economic regulation, governmental financial manipulation, and the extensive application of fiscal policy. In addition, both the Depression and World War II led to the creation of organizations like the World Bank, the IMF, and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT. The 1960s were a pivotal decade in this period and in the shift from neoclassic to Keynesian economics. It happened under the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, and perhaps the most important single influence was one man, Robert McNamara. McNamara was a frequent visitor to their discussion groups, in absentia, of course. They all knew about his meteoric rise to fame from manager of planning and financial analysis at Ford Motor Company in 1949 to Ford's president in 1960, the first company head selected from outside the Ford family. Shortly after that, Kennedy appointed him Secretary of Defense. McNamara became a strong advocate of Keynesian approach to government, using mathematical models and statistical approaches to determine troop levels, allocation of funds, and other strategies in Vietnam. His advocacy of aggressive leadership became a hallmark not only of government managers, but also of corporate executives. It formed the basis of a new philosophical approach to teaching management at the nation's top business schools, and it ultimately led to a new breed of CEOs who would spearhead the rush to global empire. As they sat around the table discussing world events, they were especially fascinated by McNamara's role as president of the World Bank, a job he accepted soon after leaving his post as Secretary of Defense. Most of John's friends focused on the fact that McNamara symbolized what was popularly known as the military-industrial complex. He had held the top position in a major corporation, in a government cabinet, and now at the most powerful bank in the world. Such an apparent breach in the separation of powers horrified many people in the discussion. John may have been the only one among them who was not in the least surprised. Now, John saw that Robert McNamara's greatest and most sinister contribution to history was to jockey the World Bank into becoming an agent of global empire on a scale never before witnessed. He also set a precedent. His ability to bridge the gaps between the primary components of the corporatocracy would be fine-tuned by his successors. For instance, George Shultz was Secretary of Treasury and Chairman of the Council on Economic Policy under Nixon, served as Bechtel President, and then became Secretary of State under Reagan. Caspar Weinberger was a Bechtel Vice President and General Counsel, and later the Secretary of Defense under Reagan. Richard Helms was Johnson's CIA Director and then became Ambassador to Iran under Nixon. Richard Cheney served as Secretary of Defense under George H.W. Bush, as Halliburton President, and as U.S. Vice President to George W. Bush. Even a President of the United States, George H.W. Bush, began as founder of Zapata Petroleum Corp., served as U.S. Ambassador to the UN under Presidents Nixon and Ford, and was Ford's CIA Director. Looking back, John was struck by the innocence of those days. In many respects, they were still caught up in the old approaches to empire building. Kermit Roosevelt had shown them a better way when he overthrew an Iranian Democrat and replaced him with a despotic king. The EHMs were accomplishing many of their objectives in places like Indonesia and Ecuador, and yet Vietnam was a stunning example of how easily they could slip back into old patterns. It would take the leading member of OPEC, Saudi Arabia, to change that. And we will continue the story of Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times million copy bestseller, in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.